that we had a Bosch product. In the upper half plane. Finitely many points. And we had this calculation. E prime ZJ was something like ZJ, ZJ over ZJ minus ZJ bar. I'll check all of this in a second. And then we had our candidate for the interpolating function with target values AJ was this one. And of course I won't remember it, so we'll look it up. So this, of course, is an analytic function because the B vanishes at ZJ, and it obviously takes the right, well, it takes the right values if you actually do a little computation, which we did last time. The computation was arranged to get so we could easily factor BZ out. And of course, G of ZJ is AJ. And then we noticed last time as well that the norm, well, every other solution to this problem here, that's H infinity function taking these values, differs from this particular one by an H infinity function vanishing on all the points, which of course then by factoring out the zeros is of the form B of Z times an H infinity function. So we then notice that the solution of least normal, I guess I should say the least normal solutions, so the least norm of solutions is just the infimum over H's in H infinity of, well, this thing minus an arbitrary H infinity function that vanishes. In other words, minus B of Z times something. Last time we did this, we took the B of Z out, and because it has modulus 1 on the boundary, which is the real line, we could just write this as J equals 1 to N AJ. Now the BZ has come out, so this is just 1 over B prime ZJ. And this is Z minus ZJ, except that we can, the infimum over H, and we can take this, oops, to the boundary. So this is now an L infinity function. This is still the boundary values of a holomorphic function, and it's this particular infimum. That's as far as we had gotten last time. And now we wanted to use some duality in the following form. We have H1 is a closed subspace of L1, which is separable. So yes, at the end of Thursday, it was pointed out that for separable spaces, the Hahn-Banach theorem didn't require the axiom of choice. I was surprised and basically indicated that I doubted it was true. But you just look at the proof, and it's obvious. Anyways, I've changed the proof in the appendices to reflect the fact that for separable Banach spaces, the Hahn-Banach theorem works without the axiom of choice, which I'm just surprised that, A, I never noticed it, but nobody else ever pointed it out to me until you did on Thursday. So that's interesting. Anyways, we have this. And
by the way, regarding the previous inequality, we use this factorization, right? With any.
Yeah. H infinity, well, we use the fact that if H is in H infinity, vanishes on the set of Z's, that implies H over B is still in H infinity, same norm. Same norm. And that was that thing in the appendices. Yeah. That's a very useful property of Blaschka products on the disk. You can't do this factorization stuff in higher dimensions. Even though there is a notion of generalized Blaschka product, it's no longer something that you can divide out by. But still very useful. And as I said before, I think it will lead to a proof of the interpolation theorem for the Drury-Arbison space in higher dimensions. But that's still not done. But I think it's closer. Yes, we have that. And now we're going to use the duality. And of course, there's the dual statement. It simply says that you can identify the continuous linear functionals on H1 isometrically with the dual of L1 factored out by the annihilator. So, I mean, what does this mean? Basically, every continuous linear functional on H1 by the Hahn-Banach theorem can be lifted to a continuous linear functional on L1. So every continuous linear functional here, there's lots of extensions here that are norm-preserving. However, any two such norm-preserving, any two such extensions, their difference will vanish on H1. Now, if the difference vanishes on H1, that's by definition saying that the difference lies in the annihilator. So as sets, you can see that this is probably true. You just have to verify the norm, but that's really relatively routine. So we have this, and of course this is L infinity over, well, I claim H infinity. So at this point I should actually probably say a few things. So I'm claiming that the annihilator of H1, and this is where the duality pairing is, duality pairing. You integrate over R, f of x, g of x, dx. So f could be here in L1 and the g in L infinity. So it's just the standard duality pairing without the bar, though, right? Just that duality pairing. I would like to just, there's a subtle little point having to do with H1 perp being H infinity here on the upper half plane, because we're using an infinite measure, dx on the boundary, instead of a finite measure, like d theta on the circle. In the case of the circle, just for comparison, if you wanted to compute the perp of H1, it would not be H infinity, it would be a subset of H infinity. The reason is because H1 on the circle contains constants. And so the constant functions are also in H infinity, and constant against itself, you don't get zero. I mean, 1 against 1 times 1 is 1, you integrate, you get 1. It turns out, of course, then to be simply H infinity that vanish at the origin. In other words, Z times H infinity. And that's because if you multiply just think of terms of power series. If you have an H1 function and one of these things, you multiply them, it still remains holomorphic. And this guy, because of the Z shifting at 1, makes sure that the first coefficient in the product is 0. So the analysis of showing that this is equal to this, you basically just pass through the power series representation, which is, of course, nothing but passing to the Fourier series, because the coefficients are the Fourier coefficients. Over here, so now we can come over here on the line. I don't draw the picture here, though, instead. So now instead of the circle with d theta is a finite measure, we now have the real line with dx infinite measure. And if you look at H1, well, I mean, I haven't actually defined it. I just told you it's the same definition. You look at all lines in the upper half plane, positive distance up, horizontal lines, and you restrict f to this line and integrate its L1 norm, integral of mod f. And you want that to be uniformly bounded. And once again, you have all the standard monotonicity and everything, and you end up getting boundary values F star that are in L1, and you have, moreover, a non-tangential maximal function of F is in L1. You take the stoop over all the points in here. All that stuff goes through exactly the same proofs. However, when you're all done, the restrictions of F to the boundary, this F star, of course it's going to have Fourier transform vanishing on the negative axis, but it's also going to... No, it's L1. Yeah, this is Hardy space. This is H. It's the holomorphic space. Yeah, it uses... Yeah. And so you get it in L1, and in fact, what you get is that F star X... This is a necessary condition. The functions have mean zero on the boundary. They're mean zero. And the proof of that... I actually didn't look up the proof. I started looking it up and realized it was going to be too... delicate. It's not that hard, but intuitively it's easy to see why such a condition is reasonable. First of all, notice that the constants aren't in here because the function 1 is not integrable. It's an infinite measure. But in fact, if you just look at the real part of f, and suppose the real part of f had a little bump in it. I mean, this is just, you know, games, but still, if the real part of f was non-negative, and had a little bump so that it was not mean zero, right? And suppose it, the graph of it looked like, just transported over here somewhere. Then it's easy to see that the non-tangential maximal function is going to be at least, if this is like a unit thing, at least 1 over the distance. It's going to look like 1 over the distance to the bump. And 1 over the distance to the bump is not integrable. It's not an L1 function. So you would not get NF in L1 unless... Well, you certainly wouldn't get NF and L1 for if F had a real part like this. And in fact, you can prove this. The fact that the H1 the functions already have mean zero accounts for the fact that you don't have to take H infinity with mean zero here. The mean zero is already here. It's just the holomorphic. So anyways, what?
The fact that the dual of H1 is H infinity?
No. All I'm... Oh.
Or the perpendicular?
Yeah. The annihilator, yeah. I'm not going to give a detailed proof. I've just been making this remark that it's reasonable to expect that the annihilator of H1 is H infinity. So I realize once I get here now that This, by the way, is easy to prove on the circle. I mean, rigorously. It's already, I'm sure, in the appendices, if you just unravel it. It occurred to me that I probably should include a section in the appendix on the upper half plane. I haven't done that yet. So I didn't really realize until today that there are some issues with the half plane that are not entirely analogous, one of them being the fact that it measures infinite. Vanishing. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. And that goes under the name of the Paley-Wiener theorems. And I mean, I haven't done that. But the Paley-Wiener theorem is the one that says that if you have a function in H1, this definition I just gave you, actually, I guess it's for H2. If you have a function in H2, then it's given as the Fourier-Laplace transform of a function supported on the positive real line, 0 to infinity, of an L2 function. That's one of the Paley-Wiener theorems. And you have to use that analysis. So, I mean, I haven't done this, so I'm basically just asking you to accept it until I put it in the appendix, what goes on in the upper half plane. It's similar to what goes on in the circle, but it has at least this one difference. Okay, so let's just assume this then. I mean, I've made some comments about it, but it doesn't follow from what I've done in the appendix. Although it's not hard, but similar. Okay, so now we go back here. What is this infimum? Well, this is obviously the norm of this function, this L infinity function, if you projected it onto the quotient, L infinity over H infinity. This number is the norm of that thing in that quotient space. So how do I say that? Let me just call this star, which is continue on. Star is equal to the norm of that thing, aj 1 over b prime zj, x minus vj, the norm of that thing in the dual space, in the quotient space, L infinity modulo H infinity. That's how you define the norm in the quotient space. It's the minimum of all the elements in the coset. All of these elements are in the same coset. The element of minimal norm in the coset is the norm in the quotient space. And the quotient space stuff is really very elementary. It's basically just definition chasing. There's no big theorem involved there. So we get this, but now we can use this duality. This norm can also be computed via the Hahn-Banach theorem, can be computed as viewing this thing as a continuous linear functional on H1. So of course its norm as a continuous linear functional on H1 is by definition obtained by souping this in the pairing against H1 functions of norm 1, the unit ball. So this is the soup F H1, whose norms are at most 1, and then you integrate it with the standard pairing, so this will be sum of aj, and then it's just going to be f of x over b prime zj, x minus zj. So this one was simply writing it as a quotient norm, observing that this infimum was a quotient norm. This one is the duality statement. I guess I should have said earlier that the least norm is given by this. This also already used the fact that the norms live on the boundary. That was an important point last time, that you can take the norms at the boundary, because this is no longer holomorphic. So we use the fact that the norms live on the boundary for the Hardy spaces. Then we use, that was recognized as a quotient norm. Then we use duality, and now the next step is we use Cauchy's theorem. And Cauchy's theorem will give us, so this is F and H1. So Cauchy's theorem, of course, you just do this. And what you get is 2 pi I. Well, this is a modulus, so the I can just be ignored. So it's 2 pi. And then it's the sum of aj. And then in this thing here, of course, you're going to get 2 pi I times the residues. But the residue is just f at zj. So you just get f of zj. Okay, it's the residue theorem, I guess. Residue theorem, FZJ over that with the absolute value. So we've now gotten rid of the integral. So this is really part of the cute part of the proof. I mean, the recognizing it as a quotient norm using duality and then Cauchy's theorem or the residue theorem. And suddenly, this infimum, which looks really, well, especially the original infimum, which was that candidate G and then subtracting off B times H, looked really hard to compute. Suddenly, this is looking really computable. And in fact, we can now do the following. Recall that MZ was the norm of the factored restriction map, so that's kernel onto L infinity. The norm of the inverse of that factored restriction map. Remember, we have a finite sequence here, finite set of points. So this map is surely onto. I mean, polynomials tell you you can do that. And remember that MZ was defined, so that means you have been a one-to-one map from H infinity mod the kernel of R onto L infinity. So by the open mapping theorem, it's invertible. These are finite dimensional spaces anyways. It's very trivial. So we have MZ, which is the norm of the inverse. How do you compute the norm of the inverse in terms of what we have on the blackboard? Well, you first of all look at the suit over all sequences, target sequences, in the unit ball of your target, little l infinity. And then what's the best norm that you can put here for a given sequence? Oh, R tilde is just the restriction map, but on the quotient space. Remember, R mapped H infinity to L infinity. So something maps H infinity modulo its kernel. You might just want to continue to call it R, but if you want to be pedantic, it's just the restriction map on the cosets. It's the same map.
It's onto because R was onto.
Yes. Yeah, and R was onto because it's just a finite set. Polynomials map you on. Okay. I mean, we have a candidate. The G maps us. L infinity of Z, finitely many elements, capital N elements. Of course, the whole point of what we're doing is to get estimates independent of that number of elements so that we can take a limit with normal families at the end. But okay, so we want to take the soup of these things. But the soup of these things, which we're hard looking to compute, after all this magic, is this easy thing to compute. Well, it's this. So it's the soup. I will maybe not write out the whole thing again. But it's 2 pi and then this stuff. But now we have a wonderful thing. We used to have an inf there. Now we have a soup and a soup. We can interchange these two. If we take the soup over the a's first in a little l infinity, obviously all you're going to get is the little L1 norm of the other stuff. So now we interchange the soups, take the soup over the unit ball of the target data, and we get this nice formula. F in H1, norm at most 1. And let me leave the constant out for a second. This will be the sum of modulus F of ZJ. And now the B prime, let me just write that back in the form of the bj zj times that thing up there. What is zj minus zj bar? It was 2i yj. Well, the I goes away because of the absolute values. The other 2 comes out. We get a 4 pi in front. And we now get the bj zj on the bottom. Remember that these BJZJs are the things that come up in the uniform separation condition, condition 5 in the theorem. Right? These are uniformly bounded below by delta sub Z. That's correct. We're in Canada. Z. And look at this. This is nothing but our favorite... Oh, I forgot to put the YJ in. That's important. Sorry. The YJ. I put the 2 in, but I forgot the YJ. This is our favorite measure. This is the YJ, and there's the delta ZJ acting on F. This is nothing but that measure divided by this extra factor that comes up that we call the measure associated to Z. We called it mu. So recall that we have d mu z which in the rest of the proof we define as the sum of the yj delta zj's. Right? That's the measure with mass equal to distance to the boundary at each point zj. Well, what is this then? This is exactly... MZ, yes. It involves it. Because MZ, the norm of this operator, is you first of all take, remember it's the inverse operator, so it's the soup over all the AJs in the unit ball of the what used to be the target space, now this is the domain space. And you're looking at, given the point in here, what's the norm in this space? Well, the norm in that space is, by definition, this thing. So what you're looking at is the soup over all AJs in the unit ball here of the norm of their image.
The worst case of the best solution.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, exactly. And so what you got was the worst case of, and then here the inf. It's really an inf, right? But we, by using trickery, we changed it to a soup. And that was really, really useful because soups can be interchanged. So in terms of this measure d mu, this is just what we would call 4 pi. Let's also define a d mu to be the same thing but divided by the funny factor. Oh, we took the soup. When you take the soup, I exchanged the soups, and now you take the, this is just a finite sum. If you take the soup over all elements in the univalve of L infinity, you get the L1 norm of that. It's really quite amazing. I mean, it's, so you get the L1 norm of that. And then, yeah, I got the 4 because the 2 came from here. You see, from here. I'm rewriting the B prime ZJ back in the form it used to be. And this form here, this is 2i yj. So there's a 2i yj times that goes upstairs. And so there's the 2, there's the yj, and the I disappears because of the modulus. Yeah, it's a very, a lot is happening very quickly. On these boards. I mean, huge progress is being made. And I know sometimes it seems like boards get filled and not much happens. A lot happens right in this proof. A lot happens right here. So we have 4 pi times, and then this is what I would call the H1 Carlson norm, i.e. the norm of the inclusion H1 contained in L1 of this measure. Right? It's just the embedding norm. Remember, everything is finite, so this certainly is included in there. But this is the norm of the inclusion, right? Because you're taking now you're taking the soup over F in the unit ball of H1, and you're looking at the integral, because this thing, of course, this part, is just the norm of F in L1. D nu z, by definition. So this is just the embedding norm. This is often called the Carlson norm, but it's with respect to the H1 space. This is incredible, by the way. Very seldom do you get nice equalities in this area. Well, actually, that's not quite true anymore. But this is an equality. This is equal. Remember, if you're going to be able to do interpolation in general for infinite sequences, you're going to have this M remain uniformly bounded as your sequence gets bigger. So this is the thing which is... So this calculation shows exactly that it's the Carlson measure norm of this thing which you must keep uniformly bounded. It's exact. Anyways, now we have to make a few estimates. The estimates are that we recall also that BJ... ZJ, the infimum of all these things, was defined to be delta z, which by condition 5 is positive. So that means here, we can take a 1 over delta z out, and now I can write equal to or less than 4 pi over delta z times this guy, the mu z measure, H1 Carlson. So I'm just taking out, because these are positive measures, just taking out the worst this can ever be. But this thing we can compute using, and I guess we haven't used this theorem yet. No, we haven't. The fact that H1 factors as a product of two H2 factors with equality of norms. Because our condition 3 tells us information about the H2 Carlson norm of mu z. Remember that H2 Carlson, that was the embedding norm into H2, or the embedding norm of H2 into L2 of the measure mu. So we have information about H2. So now we're going to use the factorization, and we instantly get the obvious bound that this is controlled by the H2 Carlson norm. And that, of course, as if you remember, we had showed was dominated by 1 plus log of 1 over delta z. And you put it together, and we're done. So let's put that here. But we claim that d mu z H1 Carlson is equal to or less than d mu z H2 Carlson. It might be equal. I haven't thought about it, but we don't care. Since, if you look at, since if f is an H1, implies f is gh with g and h in H2, the norm in H1 is the product of the norms in H2. And so if it's just trivial. If you look at f squared d mu z integrated over the upper half plane, you didn't want to square it, would have run into trouble real quick. This, of course, is equal to f times g in modulus, which is equal to or less than f squared d mu z g squared d mu z. And now, by definition, each of these is equal to or less than the H2 Carlson norm. So we look at mu z H2 Carlson. And so here we have to be careful. Yikes, I didn't think about this ahead of time. So I'm defining the Carlson norm to be the embedding. So then maybe this is the H1 Carlson norm. So what's my definition for the H2 Carlson norm? It would be the one that I just get this times f. It depends what you, how you define it, whether the square of this or the square root of this or not. So I'm defining it to be the actual norm of the inclusion. So it would be that. And then the same thing here. So I'm probably going to have that with this specialization. That's my guess, but we'll see in a minute. So this will be g. Oh, sorry, why did I put f? G and h. So down here, this is g. And then the same thing, mu z H2 Carlson, H2. So here you get mu z H2 Carlson times, because the product of g and h is equal to H1, you get that squared. So therefore, you now take the soup over all f in the unit ball, and you get that the H1 Carlson norm is at most the square of the other embedding norm in H2. But we have an estimate for that. And the estimate was that the square of the embedding norm was dominated by 1 plus log. I mean, if you look, yeah. I don't know what normalization I referred to before, but hopefully it was that one. Anyways, but from 3, condition 3, we have that it's finite because we've already shown that it's equivalent to 5 and 4. I guess we've left out 2 so far. But from 3, we have that not only is this H2 Carlson measure finite, we even had an estimate for it. We wrote it down the last time, and it was this constant ln, or sorry, constant 1 plus log 1 over delta z. Okay, if you put that in there and plug it in here, we finally get that mz is equal to or less than what we wanted. So mz is a constant 1, or a constant over, so I absorbed the 4 pi in this constant, which I haven't made an attempt to keep good track of. And we get that. And as I mentioned before, this 1 over delta, log 1 over delta growth for the norm in terms of the delta is achievable. It's achievable for finite set Z that consists of the roots of certain roots of unity, and you have to adjust the distance to the boundary with the number of roots appropriately. It's in Garnett's book. And you can show that this delta can't be improved. You must have at least 1 over delta log 1 over delta. So that completes the proof of 1 is equivalent to 3, 4, and 5. We still have to put in 2.
So, could you remind the
what they are?
The outline of how did we apply,
We started out, one is the fact that you can do the onto interpolation in L infinity. Incidentally, this last statement here, what we approved, that this mz is dominated by this independent of the size of z. So there's still something to do, and let's let z go to infinity. And then you get solutions, and you have to show that there is a normal family that converges, and it still is a solution. So there's a little bit of complex analysis left, but I'm leaving that out. But once you have this uniformity in finite sets, you can pass to the infinite one using normal families. Okay. So what did we do? This is the onto interpolation, which I now claim we've proved. At the beginning, we showed that 1 implied 5. That was the uniform, that was the BJs, ZJs were uniformly bounded below. This is condition 5. And we got that just by looking at the inverse, the fact that the MZ must be finite. We used the open mapping theorem to show that MZ must be finite. And then we divided out by the Blaschka product. It preserved the norm, and we got that after we divided out by the Blaschka product. So we used that heavy machinery about dividing out the zeros of an H-infinity function to get that 5 held. Then we proved that 5 implied 4 by, that's the Carlson testing condition over tenths. And that was by using those inequalities about the logarithm. You remember there were these inequalities about the tangent line of the logarithm, and the action was all taking place near here, so you could have... Anyways, that was all that stuff with products and sums being interchanged. So that the infinite product was positive if and only if the corresponding sum was finite, and that was the connection here. 4 was the Carlson measure condition. It trivially implied condition 3 by testing on reproducing kernels. And all of this stuff went back easily. I forget how. 3 implies 4 was to go from the embedding to the Carlson. I guess this one was testing on reproducing kernels. This is very simple. It's basically the definition. Sorry. One of the directions, this direction, was the non-tangential maximal function. I forgot that, the non-tangential maximal function. That's where we had to use it. This one going back was testing over reproducing kernels. So it wasn't quite trivial. Actually, it's an interesting thing that we actually are mentioning that for the moment. This uses somehow, analysis. What do I mean by that? It'll come in a minute. And then 4 implied 5 was, I forget, but it couldn't have been too hard. So basically, all these three were bundled up together. And we've now shown that they're the same as one. We're going to, in a moment, when we get done with this, I guess after the break, I mean, we haven't finished this yet. I still have to bring in two. But that's not going to be too hard. After the break, we're going to show how you can go from 5 to 1 without using duality. This is Peter Jones's proof. And it's different. It's different enough and it's important enough that we have to use it because it's an important technique when you try to extend corona theorems and interpolation theorems to other settings. Peter Jones's argument works where the other ones are hard to get to work. And we'll talk about that later. So we need Peter Jones's proof as well as this proof. Also, there's a third proof. So there's three proofs of this that are, in my mind, very distinct. The first one is the duality proof, the original one of Carlson. The second one is Peter Jones's proof that it's incredibly beautiful. It's an incredibly clever proof. But you'll see what it's like after the break. And the third one is the proof that goes by pure Hilbert space theory. And of course, it does not involve condition 4. It does not involve condition 4, because condition 4 is a geometric characterization of the embedding map, and that's analysis, no matter how you look at it. So there is going to be a proof that 1 is equivalent to 3 is equivalent to 5 is equivalent to 2. In other words, everything but 4. 4 is that testing condition over tenths. That's analysis. If you leave that one out and you just look at the other ones, there's almost a virtually Hilbert space proof of that. It uses the Nevin-Lena-Pick property, which you can find a proof of it on pages like 3 and 4 of Garnett's book. It's very elementary. However, I don't think that's the way to prove it. We're going to prove it using Saracen's original approach, which will take us through tuplets and Hankel operators. But they all have other dividends to pay, so I think it's useful to go that route. And once we have that Nevin-Lena-Pick theorem, there's some sort of Hilbert space magic shows all these things are the same. And that's also an interesting proof, because it doesn't use any analysis, no duality. Basically uses, positivity of positive definite matrices, infinite matrices on Hilbert space. It's really quite remarkable. So those are the three proofs of interpolation that we have to go through. All of those proofs will play a role later on. I mean, they all get used in different situations. So we have to know all of them. But first, we have to include condition 2 before the break. And part of the reason I just went through all that preamble was because the way I want to bring condition 2 in, I want to use Hilbert space techniques right now. So I will give the Hilbert space proof that 2 is equivalent to the rest of them. Now, when I say Hilbert space, I guess there's still, at this point in time, there's still Blaschke products in it. But as we'll see later, these Blaschke products can also be done in a purely Hilbert space setting when you have something called a complete Nevin-Lena-Pick kernel. But that's a little ways off. So eventually this will become a purely Hilbert space proof. Although right now you're still going to see factorization of Blaschke products in the proof. Okay, so we now show condition 2 implies our uniform separation condition. That will be easy. Just factor out zeros of an H2 function. And for the converse, we'll show that the embedding implies um, what is the converse going to be? At this stage, the converse will be 1. Because remember, we have that 1 and 5 are already equivalent by the other things we've done. So to bring 2 into the picture, we'll show that 1 implies 2 by introducing a couple of Hilbert space quantities. Unconditional basic sequences in a Hilbert space and respaces in a Hilbert space. And that will be the connection going back this way. And these will be important later on, so we'll introduce them now. But let's first of all start with this one. So first, how do we get the uniform separation out of 2? Remember what 2 was. 2 was the fact that R takes H2 onto L2 mu z. We're not assuming it's into, just it could miss, but it certainly contains everything. And remember the lemma we had at the beginning said that if, as long as it includes this, we could do it with control. We could find solutions, it pre-images with control. So the lemma implies that for every sequence zeta in L2 mu z, there exists an F in H2 such that two things happen. First of all, RF is zeta, so it does restrict to the right numbers, and you can do it with control. That is, that the H2 norm of F is dominated by some constant times the weighted L2 mu norm of the sequence. So remember, this was the very first application I gave you of the closed graph theorem. Remember, I said it was the most complicated one that I know of. All other applications of closed graph are simpler. Anyways, once you have that control, you now just divide out the zeros, and you're done. So, as usual, we let B be the Blaschke product with zeros Z, where B is a Blaschke product with zeros z, and then you get that f over b is an h2. Oh, maybe I should call it g. Call it something else. It was an h2 with the same norm. So the h2 norm of this is the h2 norm of f. Oh, I haven't told you what f is. Sorry. Squeeze a line in there. So b is the Blaschke product with zeros. Now let's say zeta upper k be the sequence, you know, with all zeros except the 1 in the kth position. And let f in H2 be the solution up there. So RF equals zeta k, and H2 norm of F equal to or less than a constant times the norm of that thing in little L2 mu. What is that? What is that? Well, this sequence has a 1 in the kth spot and zeros elsewhere. So you look at the mass of the measure mu at the kth spot, that's 1 minus z k squared. And of course you take square root of it because of L2 norm, little L2 norm. So it's that closed graph theorem lemma that tells us we can choose an f with this small norm that does the trick. And of course g now has, you divide out the zeros of f. Sorry, not of all of B, though. Okay, so you divide out this. That's, remember, BK is the complete Blaschke product for B, except you leave out the factor corresponding to the kth zero, right? It's everything but that guy. So now, this is a Blaschke product. The zeros of F match those. I mean, the zeros of F vanishes on the zeros of this guy because of all these zeros. So therefore, this is an H2. And what do you get? G at, let's write it out in the middle. What's G of ZK? G of ZK is, of course, just F of ZK over BK ZK. And if I take absolute values, then it's that. F of ZK, of course, is 1. So this is 1 over BK ZK. This is the thing, by the way, that we want to bound from above, because we want to bound the B's from below. That's condition 5, so bounding this from above. But here, what do? You just write this as G with the reproducing kernel corresponding to ZK. And this, of course, by definition, is equal to or less than the H2 norm of G and the H2 norm of KZK. Oh, incidentally, I guess I didn't tell you at this point, was here for this first one, we're working in the disk again. I know we flip back and forth. The disk is always easier, except sometimes, when dealing with that uniform separation, if you have to, especially if you have to deal with the geometry, with the tense. But here we're back in the disk. So what do we get? We get this times the square root, 1 minus zk squared. And of course, what's the H2 norm of that? Well, it's of course just the inner product, kzk against kzk square rooted. But since kzk is a reproducing kernel, it reproduces the value of the function itself. And you remember, we know what this thing is on the disk. For H2, it's 1 over 1 minus VK squared. Right? Because the reproducing kernel is 1 over 1 minus the bar of this times that. So it's just that guy. Anyways, they cancel. So that implies 5. Because it says that the B's are uniformly bounded below by 1 over that constant, whatever it is. The constant in the from the closed graph theorem. Okay, well, I think we're just going to do the last part really quickly. It's not hard. Yeah, except that I haven't introduced the conditions yet. Maybe it's best just to break for 10 minutes here. We'll do the unconditional basic sequence, the respaces after. It's really simple Hilbert space, but I have to write it out. And then we'll be able to do the first part of Peter Jones's proof. It's really short compared to this. It's just incredibly clever. I really like the proof. Okay, so 10 minutes. Okay. So now, we're going to prove that 1 implies that the set of reproducing kernels, KZJ, corresponding to our zeros, satisfy the UBS condition, or unconditional basic sequence. What does that mean? It means that at least for finite sums, where things make sense, but it's going to be uniform over all finite sums, if you have AJ KZJ, in H2, it's going to be equal to or less than BJ KZJ H2 whenever the AJs are smaller than the BJs in modulus. So this is a fairly strong condition. It says that whenever you can write a linear sum of reproducing kernels from your ZJs, and it has, of course, it'll have an H2 norm. I'm thinking of the finite sums here for the moment. And if you replace the coefficients by something whose modulus is equal to or less than, then you still get a function with roughly the same H2 norm, or at least not a lot, not much bigger. Unconditional basic sequence. So the unconditional means that basically you can, it depends only on the modulus of the BJs, because obviously you could put here the modulus of BJ, and so that's what it means by unconditional. You can multiply by the sequences by arbitrary arguments and decrease their norm. And the proof of this is that magic fact about eigenvectors of multiplication operators. So recall that M C star acting on a KJ is phi of ZJ bar KZJ for phi in the multiplier space of H2. And remember last time we showed that the multiplier space of H2 is exactly H infinity. We showed the equivalence, equality of norms, etc. Well, condition 1 will tell us that if we're given an element like this in H2, we can find a multiplier phi, an H infinity function, that takes the values, what? You want to convert this to that. So it's going to take the values AJ over BJ at ZJ. That's a little L infinity sequence, so it can be done. So by 1, there exists phi in H infinity, the multiplier space, such that phi of ZJ equals AJ BJ. And of course, this is in unit ball of little l infinity by this condition. Modulus is equal to less than 1. So we can do that. And we can do it with control of norm. The H infinity norm is at most MZ times the norm of this guy, so it's at most MZ. So I'll write that out. There exists a phi such that this happens, and the norm of phi in H infinity is at most this constant of the inverse map. It's the best one. Okay, now what do we know? But then M, So what's m phi star acting on sum of bj kzj? It's, you can, by linearity, you move this inside acting on the kzj. This is exactly, okay. So obviously, I wanted to choose the targets to be the complex conjugates of those because I want CZJ bar to be AJ over CJ. I want that to be the cancellation. So this will be the sum over BJ, and then here you have AJ over BJ, and the two bars cancel each other, KZJ. So you just get the thing on the left. So you see the multiplier operator takes the one on the right-hand side to the function on the left-hand side. You get there by a multiplier operator. And then you're done. Because, so, then the operator norm of the adjoint on H2, of course, equals the multiplier, the norm of the multiplier operator M phi 2. We showed last time that under the identification with H infinity, that's just the H infinity norm of phi, and the H infinity norm of phi was equal to or less than mz. So in fact, we've proved UBS with constant, with phi equals mz, because the thing on the left is m phi star. But then you take m phi star out, the operator norm, it's just that times the b. So that's already some of the Hilbert space trickery. That's actually a good instance of it. As I said before, I'm getting the feeling, I'm sort of learning this stuff as we will go, except I'm maybe a few chapters ahead. But it looks like this, this fact here, the fact that reproducing kernels are eigenvectors of adjoints of multiplier operators with eigenvalue equal to the, that seems to be the key to the entire structure. Everything is, You just play this for what it's worth in other situations. And it turns out you can milk it for a lot. So this apparently is the beginning, the underpinning, a foundation of all the Hilbert space magic that's going to occur, is that type of thing.
What are the eigenvalues or the eigenfunctions of the multiplier itself?
I don't know. Does anybody know? I don't think they have a nice description. I think it's just sort of magic that the adjoints of multiplier operators have a nice description. And you're going to play that for all it's worth. It's really surprising. I mean, who would have thought? You know, you have multiplier operators, you have reproducing kernels. Who would have thought that there was some incredible connection like that? I mean, once it's been pointed out to you, you can say, yeah, of course. But I certainly didn't know that there would be such a thing. Okay, now we have to show that this UBS condition implies another abstract condition called the respaces condition, which is in the appendix somewhere now, at least on the most recent version, which Jason will hopefully put on the web today. So now we show that if we have the KZJs, our UBS, then, and of course there's nothing, at this point there's nothing special, now that we're in the world of purely abstract stuff, there's nothing special about, this is just a sequence of elements in the Hilbert space that satisfy UBS. It doesn't have to be KZJs, it can just be any element. But I'll still continue to use this notation, but we'll see, we don't use any reproducing properties for this part. Then they satisfy respaces condition. The respaces simply says this, that the sum of aj squared is, with a small constant, is equal to or less than the norm aj kzj h2 equal to or less than a big constant. So, what is this a generalization of? First of all, if the KZJs Ah. So they do have to be normalized. If the KZJs were orthogonal, then this would be an orthonormal sequence. And for an orthonormal sequence, this thing for finite sums would be equal to that, right? It's just equal to the little L2 norm of the coefficients. So this simply says that it's approximately equal. So it's approximately an orthonormal sequence. In fact, it's not very hard to show that this, you can use as your definition, as Nikolsky does, that KJ satisfy this respaces condition if and only if there is an isomorphism, but not a linear isomorphism, not a Hilbert space isomorphism, but a bounded operator with that takes this set of functions to a set which actually is orthonormal in another Hilbert space. And in that other Hilbert space, of course, you do have equality, and then you come back, and that's where you get the constants, because the map isn't a Hilbert space isomorphism, it's just a bounded linear map between the two. We don't care about this anymore.
It does not depend on any condition one, right? Just the fact that they are eigenvalues.
Right, yeah, this is always true.
This does depend on one. Only the balance, right?
The existence of phi depends on one. Yeah, by one. There exists a phi that does the interpolation. Because in general, you can't interpolate, right? I mean, Carlson's theorem is that you can only interpolate if the sequence Z is special.
Not granted that there is a continuum of eigenvalues.
You're trying to describe the entire problem in terms of eigenfunctions. Good. Worthwhile thinking about. I don't know. I don't know. Anyways. So this is an almost orthogonal basis. We want to get that from this, from UBS. So for this, we use the following simple Hilbert space phenomenon. The only reason that it's not day-to-day knowledge for us is because it's a theorem about many dimensions, and we can't think in many dimensions. So you'll recognize it for two. So here's what we do. We look at if U and V are non-perpendicular in our Hilbert space. These arguments work for any Hilbert space, by the way, but I'll just continue to use the notation we're using for the theorem here. Then if you look at U squared plus V squared, that's equal to or less than, and now I have to copy it out because I'll forget it. I'll get it wrong. Equal to or less than, and then here you just add twice the absolute value of the inner product. But what does that become? That becomes exactly U plus becomes exactly that. This is a Hilbert, I mean, this is an inner product space. If you expand the thing out, you're going to get U squared plus V squared, and you're going to get twice the modulus of UV. But of course, we have to have that UV is not perpendicular for this. Similarly, over here, do the same thing, but subtract this, and you'll get U minus this. U minus that. So what is this saying? It says that the quantity U squared plus V squared, which is going to show up here and here, that quantity is equal to or greater than the norm squared of U plus some unimodular function, unimodular number, that is a number of modulus 1, complex number of modulus 1 times V, and a different unimodular number over here gives you the upper bound. if U and V are perpendicular, then you can take these things to be just both one. I mean, this could just be U minus V squared, if they're perpendicular, and U plus V squared, and you get equal. So the moral is that in any case, no matter what, the following is always true. Given two vectors in the Hilbert space, there exist unimodular numbers E plus I theta V squared and equal to or greater. It doesn't matter that it's the same number, but it probably is with the minus EI theta. So there exists a theta such that this happens always. Well, you'd now like to iterate this and get it for not just a sum of two squares, but a sum of finitely many squares. And the iteration is really quite simple. What you do is for this one, you write, So now what you do, let's use chalk to, suppose we now add W squared to everything. Well, now you can see what's going to happen. Here you have two vectors with their norm squared. Just apply what we just did to this one. And for this one, you will get that the sum of the squares of these two things will be equal to or less than U plus E to the I theta V plus something E to the I C W. Right? We also have one that goes underneath this, but that's useless. We want the one that goes underneath that. So over here, you write this is equal to or greater than, and again, you use this vector. And then something, it may be a different vector now because it's a different pair. So E to the I C. Oops, no, E to the I psi. That one's times V, and this one's times W. Okay, well now you see the pattern. So we get the following inequality. That the sum of the uj squareds, there are so here there are thetas you can put in front, e to the I say theta j uj, which is underneath, and other ones say phi j, which go above. Right, because in other words, the coefficients here are just e to the I somethings. They're all different, but you get this. And this is for sum theta j phi j, depending on the uj's. Sorry, which part are you talking about?
Yeah.
Here? Yeah, and this is equal to or greater than that. Yeah. Oh, yeah, sorry, they're different. All I'm saying is that what you see here is you have one number, another number, you have three different numbers, all of modulus 1. Over here you have three completely different numbers, not all different numbers of modulus 1. So I'm saying here you just put, there exist numbers of modulus 1. Some of them are 1s, some of them may coincide with 1s over here. Who cares? I mean, yeah, there's no connection. If you just think about vectors, these are not mutually orthogonal vectors. They're just arbitrary vectors, and the fact that you can multiply them in such a way to get this isn't obvious by looking at the picture, because the picture is multidimensional. At least I don't have a good picture for why this is true. Maybe one can figure a picture out in 2 and 3 dimensions, but I didn't. But anyway, this simple algorithm gives you this. But this is really useful because now what we can do, we apply this to, see, this will be the AJs. So we will apply this to UJ equals AJ KZJ. We will apply this to that vector. To get what we want. And so what we get over here is the sum of e to the I theta j aj kzj norm kzj this thing h2. And in here, what's the norm of this? Well, this is a unit vector, so the norm is just aj, and you square it, you get aj squared, so you get this e to the I and then some other thing. Squared, of course. The norms are all squared. And now we're done. I mean, this is the right-hand inequality of UBS if you use the unconditional basic. I mean, this is the right-hand inequality of RB, the Riesz basis, if you use the fact that, you know, on an unconditional basis, for unimodular numbers, you can go either way, right? So you just go the way you want to go. And then, so it's just elementary from that point on. No, it's equivalent. It follows trivially from RB. Suppose you have RB, which says that the norm of this thing is comparable to the sum of the norms of the squares of the AJs. Then if you look over here, each side, when you square it, each side is comparable to, well, one is the AJ squares, this one's the BJ squares, and on the little L2 side, that inequality gives you trivially. So they're actually equivalent. They're almost trivially equivalent. It just uses this funny little inequality. I don't know. In many places, this sort of stuff is considered so trivial they don't even give you the proofs. But it's new to me, so I go through it. Okay. Now I'm going to finish the last part in just a second. Yeah.
Did you use UBS?
Yeah. I did it in my head. I mentioned what happens now. For UBS, this is equal to or greater than some small constant times AJ KZJ. That's where I use this is the AJ and those is the BJs. And as I mentioned, because these are unimodular, the modulus equals the modulus. You can go either way. So that means over here, you can do the same thing. Equal to or less than. Because that little constant, or this constant, is the reciprocal of that one. It's the reciprocal of the UBS constant. And this is the sum AJ ZJ. So you use UBS here and here. Here you use it with AJ, and these are the BJs. Here it's the other way around. Here, these are the AJs and those are the BJs. That's the other way. And that's the RB inequality. Well, the RB inequality, the left-hand side of RB, the right-hand side. So the right-hand inequality, of RB is just the statement that the map T, which we introduced at the very beginning and then quickly reverted back to R, maps H to little L2, where I'll remind you what T was. T of F is the sequence. It's the restriction, but weighted by whatever it is that you're supposed to wait by. That. Because this thing is just equal to what? F of zj is, of course, just f. I'll get there. I guess that's the dual statement. Let me write it out first so I can see what's going on in my head. So then, that's the f of zj. This thing, of course, is 1 over the norm of kzj. So what I wrote here is not quite correct, but we can change it. So if tf is this map, then what is t star? The adjoint. So TF obviously maps H2 to little L2.
What are H and R? The notation R, H, and R, V. R of H means right hand.
Oh! Sorry. Right hand. Inequality.
And RB.
Is the Riesz basis. Yeah, that's pretty true. R, H, and R, V are pretty... pretty similar, but they don't mean anything like so Riesz basis. Okay, so I'll get to that. Maybe it's the left hand. I don't. Anyways, and T star of a sequence AJ is then just going to be the sum of AJ's KZJ, right? And maybe there's a bar on all of this. Okay. Bars go somewhere. It's not important. I'll let you think about it. It's because of, you know, the way I wrote it. I just don't know. You can think about it. Bars, complex conjugate bars go somewhere because of the pairing.
The right-hand side says
T star is bounded, doesn't it? Because this is T, so the right-hand side says T star is bounded. That's what it says. Okay, so the right-hand side of Riesz basis is just the statement that T star, taking little l2 to h2, is bounded. Now it's correct. Where TF is that and T star of the sequence is that. Okay, but now we're done. Because... statement 3, the Carlson embedding for R just says that T is bounded. So the right-hand inequality there is that T star is bounded, but 3 is just the statement. That T is bounded. We actually even wrote that at one point. That T is bounded. And then I quickly changed it to R mapping into a weighted L2 space because it was just more convenient. But it certainly is that. So first of all, we see that right away, T and T star, of course, have the same norm. So right away, we see that the right-hand inequality of Riesz basis is equivalent to 3. So 3 is equivalent to right-hand inequality in the Riesz basis. However, given that T is a bounded operator, the fact that it's onto is equivalent to T star having an operator norm inequality. So maybe at this point I should recall, this is also in the appendix notes now. So recall that in great generality, if T maps X to Y, these are now just Banach spaces, we're in the Hilbert space realm here, but even for Banach spaces, if this is bounded, then T is onto. So there's this nice criterion for a map to be onto, and it's if and only if, first of all, I guess the simpler one is that the range of T is dense if and only if T star is 1 to 1. If it's onto, it's a little better than T star is to 1 to 1. It's T star 1 to 1 with control. So that means if and only if T star of y is equal to or greater than some little constant times the norm of y. All right, so you have this open mapping type thing for T star. Now that, this theorem, oh, the proof is not one line. The proof is a page in the appendix. And I'm probably not going to go back to the appendix for a few weeks. So I'm just saying that this theorem is not entirely trivial to prove. You have to work. It's not hard. I think it's very elementary. You can follow each step. It's very, very simple. But what you have to do, of course, it uses the open mapping theorem, obviously. And it also uses part of the proof of the open mapping theorem again. So there's some fussiness that I don't see how to get around. So, but anyways, it's true. It's a well-known principle.
Just for curiosity, if T star is just 1 to 1, then it means that the image of T is there?
Yeah. Yeah, that's easier to prove. That's the Hahn-Banach theorem, but don't ask me to prove it. I think it's trivial. I think it's just the Hahn-Banach theorem and the definition of T star. But let's recall this theorem, because this now shows. So, given T bounded, two holds, remember two was that T was onto, but now we have given that T is bounded, two holds, if and only if. What's that inequality here? That inequality is the left-hand inequality in the Riesz spaces on a Hilbert space, because that's T star, and that's equal to a greater than the thing. So, T holds if and only if. The left-hand inequality of RV holds. And so now we see that that from T, the boundedness, that from condition 3, we get down to 2. So we've shown the necessity of 2. Sorry. Ah, we wanted to show the sufficiency of 2 this time, right? I forget. Right. We wanted to get. I can't remember now what we started. Which way we proved at first. So the first thing we did was we showed that 2 was sufficient. By proving that 2 implied the strong separation by factoring out the Blaschke products. Now we wanted to show that 2 is necessary. Well, that does it. Because all the other conditions were equivalent, so we could use any one of them any time we want. In particular, 3 implies all this stuff. We had all this stuff, and then we finally get the two holds from the left-hand inequality of Riesz spaces. Which, by the way, the left-hand inequality of Riesz spaces followed from unconditional basic sequence, which in turn followed from the main event, the onto interpolation for L infinity. So we got the L infinity implied UBS. The UBS implied both the right and left-hand inequalities for RB, which by the functional analysis gave us that T was onto as well as into. Anyway, so those arguments can be reversed, although we don't need to prove it right now. Okay. Well, that's finally the end of the proof. That finally shows that all 5 of those conditions are equivalent. And as I said, we have to, this is one proof, the duality proof. When we go to the Corona theorem, which is the next chapter, we're going to use this proof for the first time, an argument of Tom Wolfe, very cleverly used, a very similar duality. But then for other spaces where we can't use this duality, we're going to use Peter Jones's proof. And then in higher dimensions, we're also going to have to use the purely Hilbert space proof, which you haven't seen yet. That will come much later. But the next step is to do Peter Jones's proof, which is very different and very useful as well. They're all useful. Yeah, we're finished. So the proof of that theorem is over. We have proven the equivalence of all five conditions. Under the assumption that we have the separation condition. Remember that even before we began, I mean, most of the time you see these theorems with the separation condition included, with the Carlson testing condition on tense. You see it included with it's 3 plus embedding, plus separation. That's probably the only two that you have to put it in. But I decided to leave the separation out as part of just a blanket assumption at the beginning, because it's actually already necessary by the open mapping theorem and closed graph theorem for the two main interpolations. There's the Hilbert space interpolation, H2 goes to little L2 of something, and it turns out that being onto already implied separation. And then there's the multiplier space interpolation, H infinity goes to little L infinity onto, that already implies separation. So since the two big events imply a separation, you may as well just assume it from the start. At least that was my reasoning in doing that. And then the subsequent statements become a little less cluttered because they don't have to refer to separation. Some of them don't need it, some of them do. But. Okay, so here's a... We can get a little bit started on this one. This is a really pretty proof. And it's very short. And... I'm going to copy out the main events because getting the right notation is important. Okay, so this time we're going to construct FK in H infinity such that FK ZJ is the delta function. So each FK will solve the problem, it's 1 at ZK and 0 at the other places. And it will satisfy an extremely strong bound. And that is that if you sum up the modulus of each of these things, which, you know, if you're not careful, this could just be the sum of a bunch of ones, could be infinity. But of course, it's going to be finite constant for all z in the disk. So this is an incredibly strong condition on the FKs. It says that the FKs are 1 near the near their, you know, the FK is 1 near ZK, but at the other points it's got to be really small because the sum of them at the other points got to add up to something bounded. So they've got to go to 0. They are 0. But even in a neighborhood they've got to remain a little small everywhere in Z. Everywhere in D they have to remain small. So we have these functions which are 1 at the ZK, and yes, they are 0 at all the other ZJs. But even when you add them up, they remain uniformly bounded. You add up the absolute values. And... Oh, Peter Jones's proof? Let Z satisfy condition 5, the uniform separation. That's it. So we're going to give a new proof. Proof of what? Proof of 5 implies 1. That's what it's a proof of. So it's a new proof. Remember, the proof we just gave was already very clever and nice, involved the duality in Cauchy's, there's a residue theorem. This proof, well, actually is far more robust than you think. It uses some harmonic function theory, but very little. So the first thing to do, of course, is figure out what's a candidate. Well, we obviously have candidates for this stuff. So first choice of candidate for FK is this one. Oh, incidentally, we could be in either the disk or the upper half plane, but this construction is most easily described in the upper half plane.
Once we have this function, then if you leave
No, no, these functions won't work. This is our candidate. We're going to go through a series of candidates. Oh, sorry. Yes. We construct functions. Then f of z equals the sum ak fkz satisfies f of zk equals ak, because only one of these functions is non-zero at zk. Has value 1. So, I mean, this is really a very strong thing, so the crude solution works. And, of course, the L-infinity norm of f is that constant there. Because, you know, times the soup norm of the sequence A. Right? Because you just take absolute values inside. Here you take out the soup, so... Right, so this is, in a sense, this is a sledgehammer being used to solve the interpolation problem. But that's why it's so interesting. And in fact, you don't have to use Peter Jones's method to prove the sledgehammer. It follows by the other methods too. But Peter Jones's method will avoid duality. So our first choice for a candidate is this. Well, how does it do? It satisfies 1. It satisfies 1, but of course not 2. Why not 2? Well, look at the boundary, for example. Here's the boundary, R. The BK, of course, is our familiar Blaschka product with all the products in it except the kth one, right, missing. So therefore, this number is non-zero, and this is now a... H-infinity function. BKZ has modulus 1 almost everywhere on the boundary. So if you restrict this to the boundary, and if you use this candidate, you actually are summing up 1s. So you're going to get infinity. So there's no hope. Nevertheless, the first trick, I think, is to see if we can somehow figure out how to make life a little bit better at infinity. Not at the other places, but at least at infinity. And then we can do the infinity trick and scale it around at all the other little points, and it'll work. Oh, I just mentioned it because BK... Z in modulus is 1 on R, which is the boundary. Remember, Blaschka products are 1 almost everywhere. But if you take that, remember, and these, oh, and also the BK ZKs, remember the separation condition says that these things in modulus are equal to or greater than delta Z, and they're obviously equal to or less than 1 because they're products of Blaschka functions. So these numbers are roughly 1. This number is 1. So therefore, the modulus of this is sandwiched between 1 and 1 over delta z. When you add those things, you get infinitely many 1s at least. So there's no hope for 2. And now, we introduce the following function, which is really the key function to the whole thing. And g of z is minus 4 over z plus I squared. Okay, why is it the key to the whole thing? Because note that, remember, in the upper half plane, I takes the role of the origin in the disk. It's the center of the upper half plane. So this function is, g is 1 at I, and it's 1, well, okay, well, that's 1, and g at infinity is 0. So if you go out far, it's 0. So at least this is a function that's 1 at the center of the disk, our upper half plane, and vanishes at infinity. And what we can do with this particular G is if you rescale it and let GKZ be equal to what? BKZ, the same thing we had before, except this time throw in a rescaled version of G. So what's GKZ? It's G of Z minus XK over YK. So what have we done? We've taken this place where it's 1, think of that as the pole of G, and if this is the point ZK over here, there's XK, there's IYK. This translates G to sit over here, and then you dilate it so that the value 1 goes down to there. So this function, GK of Z, has the property that GK of ZK is G of I, which is 1. So we just rescaled the thing to sit over here. So what it looks like is it's still 1 here, and it still decays at infinity. So it looks like, you know, like a little, it's not a Poisson integral because it doesn't grow. It stays the same size. It's sort of like an L-infinity translation. You don't compensate to make it an L1 one. You keep the L-infinity norm the same. So this is, if you like, these are the translations, the translations, of course, preserve all those things, but these are the dilations that preserve the L-infinity norm. Yes, this is the new definition of FK. So the new FK would be this. This behaves better at infinity, but it still fails locally. And the final thing is, the real trick is, we're going to introduce a factor. I can't be detailed because we're basically out of time. We would like to introduce a factor where we sum up over certain j's, given this k, and we want to sum up roughly something like gj of z in modulus over the bj zj. So what you want to do is when the gj might still be large, you want to have an e to the minus it, which will really kill it, right? I mean, exponential will really kill it. This will be a huge kill for this thing. If this gets too big, this will kill it very strongly. This is just a normalization to make it work with the things. The defect with this approach, first of all, you can't show that with this modification, the sum of the FKZs will be bounded. So this does give you property 2. However, we've sacrificed property... No, we didn't sacrifice property 1. What we sacrificed...
Why do we need the GK? Maybe we don't need it then.
Yeah, for infinity we need it.
Yes,
it's no longer holomorphic. And we can't just take away the absolute values. So Peter Jones's idea was to look at a harmonic majorant of this modulus. And then use that harmonic majorant plus I times its harmonic conjugate. And sure enough, it still worked. So that was the brilliant idea. And in the end, the fact that this ugly looking construction has a beautiful proof that it works. It's just really, I mean, I'm just astounded that he pursued it. Because it doesn't look like it's going to work. But it does. It's just incredible. Anyway, so we'll finish that proof on Thursday. So on Thursday, we're just going to continue with these things. We'll finish. This is very short. And then we'll do the D-bar equation and the connection with interpolation. It's really incredible. I like it a lot. That's out of Garnett's book. And then we'll start the Corona theorem. And we have Wolf's proof to do. Then we have a bunch of other proofs involving Peter Jones's thing to do. And then then we'll start the Toeplitz and Hankel operators so that we can do the Hilbert space theory proofs. And I'm hoping that we get a ways into that before the conference, because the week of the conference, we're going to cancel both the lectures. And I think after that, we probably won't come back to the appendices too much, because we won't have time. We'll see. But I'd like to get everything almost done by the end of March. Because after we do the Toeplitz and Hankel operators, and we get all the proof, all the sort of classical proofs for interpolation and corona in the disk setting done, Then we want to look at higher dimensions where things are much tougher, and we want to prove what we can there. It takes a long time though. So every time we prove, you know, something in higher dimensions, it takes 10 times as long as it took to prove the analogous theorem here in one dimension. But so that's the idea, is just to develop all the three basic known techniques for handling interpolation and corona here, and then try to do some of the theory in higher dimensions in March. And we may have to spill over a little bit into April. But I'm going away the first week of April, so that'll be canceled. But that should be just about it. Anyway, sorry, I went over a little bit. This. Yeah, there won't be any more appendices for a while. Maybe not ever.